if you were gonna, steal a billion-dollar diamond from a museum, you'd probably spend all your time worrying about laser grids.
Oh, yeah. Lasers, pressure sensors, armed guards, the whole Hollywood heist setup.
Exactly. But according to our source material today, you'd actually be looking in completely the wrong place.
Because the biggest vulnerability in cultural security isn't the alarm system.
Right. It's actually, well, it's usually a spreadsheet.
Yeah, it's wild to think about.
I mean, when you walk into a major museum or a gallery, your eyes are drawn to the art. You notice the hushed atmosphere, that perfect lighting.
You're definitely not looking for the security cameras.
No, you don't see this invisible, highly complex web of security that's completely surrounding you,
Yeah.
because you are stepping into a meticulously planned ecosystem of risk management.
And if that system is built on guesswork,
Or some generic out-of-the-box security plan.
yeah, exactly. If it's built on that, the institution is basically setting itself up for an absolute disaster.
Which brings us to our mission for today. We are taking a deep dive into a highly specialized source document. It's titled Part 2, Security Risk Assessing Cultural Venues.
It is such a fascinating read.
It really is. We're going to look at exactly how security professionals actually evaluate threats to our cultural treasures, how they protect the people who visit them, and why, doing this wrong can literally cost an institution everything.
Because we tend to view these spaces as static, right? Almost frozen in time.
Well, yeah, the objects inside them usually are.
Right. But the environment around those objects is incredibly dynamic. Protecting these spaces requires a level of precision and customized math that most of us never even consider.
Okay, let's unpack this. To properly protect a space, our source material makes it very clear that you first need to realize every single venue is a totally unique ecosystem.
Yeah, that is a foundational rule of this entire process. A security plan cannot just be bought off the shelf.
But the text highlights this really striking rule right out of the gate
Yeah.
that honestly, well, it confused me at first.
Oh, really? Which part?
It says that using generic threats, so words like terrorism, crime, or violence, that must be avoided at all costs.
Ah, yeah. I can see why that sounds weird.
Right. Because wait, aren't those the exact things a security team is hired to prevent? Like, if I'm running a museum, I definitely want to stop crime.
I mean, it sounds totally counterintuitive, but think about the actual mechanism of protection. If you just broadly declare, we need to stop crime, you're basically trying to boil the ocean.
How do you mean?
Well, are you preparing for a highly organized, heavily armed art heist?
Okay.
Or are you preparing for, like, a bored teenager trying to carve their initials into a 17th century wooden chair?
Oh, wow. Yeah, those are entirely different things.
Exactly. Those two scenarios both fall under the umbrella of crime, but they require vastly different protective security and risk reduction measures.
So you can't just put crime on a spreadsheet and call it a day.
No, you can't. The source points out that identifying the specific threat source is what focuses the evaluation.
And the document actually illustrates this with a really interesting paradox. It asks you to imagine two identical buildings standing right side by side.
Owned by the exact same organization, right?
Yes. So on paper, you would think they have equal levels of risk. But the text bluntly states that if you adopt that approach, you're dead wrong.
You're actually increasing your vulnerabilities if you treat them the same.
Right. I was trying to wrap my head around this and I realized it's like having two identical steel safes. One of them holds your leftover turkey sandwich, and the other holds the nuclear launch codes.
I love that analogy.
Right. The metal box is exactly the same, but the risk isn't about the box.
Not at all.
If the safe holds a sandwich, your operational culture is probably lax. You might literally leave the combination on a sticky note on the door.
Because who cares if someone steals your sandwich?
Exactly. But if it holds the launch codes, the protocols change entirely. You need a two-man rule, biometric scans, armed overwatch.
The building doesn't dictate the risk, it's the operational culture inside it.
What's fascinating here is how the source breaks down those internal variables.
Yeah, the very first variable they list is the collection being exhibited.
Right. They contrast a social history exhibit with a diamond-encrusted golden crown.
I mean, a collection of local 19th-century farming tools has a threat profile that is worlds apart from a literal pile of diamonds.
Yeah, stealing a wooden rake is a bit different than grabbing a crown.
Exactly. But it goes so much deeper than just the objects themselves.
The text lists several other crucial site-specific factors that directly affect the risk level, right? Like visitor numbers, for one.
One huge factor. A quiet local gallery getting 20 people a day operates completely differently than a major metropolitan museum processing, what, 10,000 tourists an hour?
Right. And then you have to factor in the staffing levels and their day-to-day operational activities.
And don't forget the physical infrastructure currently in place.
Like the display cases.
Yeah. What types of display cases are being used? What are the secure fittings, the CCTV coverage, the alarm systems?
But the most critical variable they mention is the security culture. And there's this heavily loaded parenthetical note they add.
Oh, I know the one. It adds, if one exists.
Yes. If one exists. That parenthetical is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
It really is. It implies that sometimes an organization just doesn't have a culture of security at all.
Which is a massive vulnerability, isn't it?
Huge. I mean, you can have capital-intensive blast-proof glass and state-of-the-art cameras, but if your security culture is so lax that staff are regularly, you know, propping secure loading dock doors open to get a breeze during the summer.
Oh, man, yeah.
Your risk level absolutely skyrockets.
So when you take all these variables, the crown, the crowds, the cameras, the culture, that identical building paradox actually makes perfect sense.
It does, which means every single venue must be risk assessed individually to ensure accuracy.
And the source really emphasizes using sensible and pragmatic protective security strategies.
Right.
You have to minimize what the text calls overkill.
Right, because if you guard the farming tools with the exact same intensity as the Diamond Crown, you're depleting your budget on completely the wrong things.
But this brings up a massive blind spot. If the culture and the contents dictate the risk, who actually determines what is valuable enough to protect?
That is the million-dollar question.
I think most people, myself included, would just assume that security makes that call.
Well, the text brings up a very sobering reality here. Security experts normally do not know or understand the historic, financial, or international worth of the assets they are protecting.
Wait, really? You're telling me the people hired to protect the priceless artifacts don't actually know what they're worth?
Generally speaking, no.
Aren't they just flying blind then?
Pretty much. I mean, they are experts in vulnerabilities, access control, threat mitigation. They are not art historians or financial appraisers.
Or international diplomats, for that matter.
Exactly. So a security guard might look at a small, slightly tarnished coin and just assign it minimal protection.
Because it just looks like an old coin.
Right. They have no way of knowing that it's the last of its kind in the world, worth $20 million, or that it has deep, controversial cultural significance to a foreign nation.
Wow. Okay, so the source is very clear about the solution here. Before any assessment even begins, you have to get the right stakeholders engaged.
Yes, whether they are internal or external.
The text advises getting these people around a table, or even just on a Teams call, to securely share information. We're talking about the museum curator, the financial director, maybe even a government representative.
Everybody needs to be on the same page.
But I have to push back on this a little bit. I mean, I have been on cross-departmental corporate calls.
Oh, we all have.
They are an absolute nightmare. How on earth do they prevent this from just turning into a giant argument?
What do you mean?
Well, the curator probably thinks every single painting is a catastrophe waiting to happen, and the finance director is going to refuse to spend a dime on new cameras, right?
Yeah, that is the exact trap, and it's exactly why the methodology in the source is so incredibly rigid. The text insists that before the assessment even starts, everyone must agree on the risk management descriptors.
So they have to build a shared objective language to measure a potential disaster.
Exactly. You have to strip the emotion out of the room.
How do they actually do that in practice, though?
It starts with a threat assessment using what they call the HIC principles. That's HIC.
Historic, intent, and capabilities, right?
You got it. Historic looks at what has actually happened in the past, either at this specific venue or similar ones.
Okay, makes sense.
Then intent asks what the adversary is actually trying to achieve, and capabilities looks at what the adversary is physically able to do.
Okay, let's put a mechanism to this so it makes a bit more sense.
Sure.
Imagine a museum has a world-famous painting on display, and there's a rising trend of protesters throwing soup at artwork to make a political statement. Walk me through the HIC calculation for that.
Oh, that's a perfect scenario. So first, historic. Have protesters thrown soup at paintings recently?
Yes, definitely.
Right. There is a clear, documented history of this globally. Second, intent. Do they want to steal the painting for financial gain?
No, not at all.
Exactly. Their intent is maximum media exposure and temporary defacement.
Okay, and the C.
Third is capabilities. Do they need elite hacking skills or automatic weapons?
No, I mean, they just need a can of soup.
Right. Their capability requirement is incredibly low, a can of soup, and a ticket to the museum.
Okay, so once you map that out, we get into the actual math of risk. The source points to a standard 5x5 approach for measuring two intersecting factors.
Likelihood and impact.
Right. For likelihood, it's a 1-to-5 scale.
Yeah.
So from unlikely up to possible, increased likelihood, likely, and probable.
And impact also runs 1-to-5.
Insignificant, minor, moderate, major, and catastrophic.
And this is where that shared objective language actually saves the team's call from descending into chaos.
Because they actually multiply the numbers, right?
Yeah.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
The math doesn't lie.
No, it doesn't. So let's say the curator and the security head agree that a soup attack is likely. That's a 4 on the likelihood scale.
Yep.
But the painting is behind protective glass, so the actual damage to the asset is just minor, which is a 2 on the impact scale.
So you multiply 4 by 2.
And you get a risk score of 8 out of 25. But what does an 8 actually mean in the real world? Like, what happens next?
An 8 dictates your budget and your physical response.
Oh, so it ties directly to the money.
Absolutely. A score of 8 might mean you just assign an extra gallery assistant to that room and ensure the protective glass is cleaned nightly.
But what if the scenario changes? What if the threat is, say, an organized crime syndicate with a history of armed robbery? They have high intent to steal for the black market and the capabilities to bypass alarms.
Well, the likelihood might only be a 3, but the impact of losing a masterpiece is a 5. It's catastrophic.
Okay, so 3 times 5 is 15.
And a 15 triggers a totally different mechanism.
So you're not just adding a gallery assistant anymore.
Not even close. A 15 might mandate serious capital expenditure. It triggers the installation of reinforced steel doors, seismic sensors in the walls, maybe a dedicated rapid response security team.
So the math just totally removes the curator's panic and the finance director's stinginess.
Exactly. The number dictates the physical barrier.
Wow. To make sure everyone is perfectly aligned on what a 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 actually means, the source provides this highly detailed risk impact matrix.
It is incredibly granular.
It really is. They break the priorities down into 4 columns: operational, injuries, reputational, and financial impact. I want to read some of the gritty specifics here because the contrast between a 1 and a 5 is wild.
It paints a very clear picture of worst case versus best case scenarios.
Yeah. So operationally, a level 5 catastrophic impact means complete loss of operational capabilities for an extended period or permanently.
Basically, the museum shuts down.
Right. Under injuries, it means loss of life and serious injuries requiring hospitalization. But the reputational column is what really caught my eye.
What did it say?
It defines a level 5 reputation impact as a proactive adverse media campaign, nationally and internationally, resulting in serious reputational damage with long recovery times.
Yikes. So it's not just a bad Yelp review.
No, it is a global coordinated public relations nightmare.
Now compare that to a level 1 or level 2.
Right. For a level 1 insignificant event, operationally, you're looking at a minor disruption to a single area for less than an hour.
Barely a blip.
Injuries mean minor bumps requiring local treatment, no hospital. Mm. Reputation is just limited adverse media.
But just bumping up 1 level to minor level 2 clearly changes the mechanism.
Exactly. The operational disruption extends to a moderate period, which they strictly define as 1 to 4 hours.
And that definition is key.
Right. But defining exactly what 1 to 4 hours of downtime means versus less than 1 hour, nobody on that team's call can argue about what minor means. It's quantified.
And as you look across those columns, the text reveals a really profound shift in how these venues view their priorities today.
Oh, how so?
Well, historically, cultural venues focused almost entirely on asset protection. You know, protecting the crown, protecting the painting.
The stuff.
Exactly, the stuff. But the text explicitly notes a recent drive regarding counterterrorism considerations.
Right.
Subject to the nature of the venue, these considerations focus heavily on the people as opposed to the collections.
Okay, so the matrix isn't just calculating the loss of canvas and paint. It's calculating the loss of human life in a crowded space.
Which fundamentally alters the math. You are no longer just guarding a diamond. You are guarding the 10,000 tourists who queued up to see it.
That is a massive shift in responsibility.
It really is. Effective protective security must consider both, based on the specific vulnerabilities. You have to secure the artifact from theft, but you also have to ensure the frontal layout doesn't create, say, a bottleneck that endangers the public during an evacuation.
Wow, okay. I did notice a really strange quirk, though, when I was reading through those columns.
Oh, which one?
So we have operational injuries, reputational, and financial impact, right?
Right.
For every single severity level, from level one all the way up to level five catastrophic, the text says financial losses or damage. But then it explicitly states in bold.
Oh, I know exactly what you're going to say.
Risk acceptance levels are presently unknown. It repeats that exact phrase for all five levels.
It is a glaring omission, isn't it? And it highlights a massive real-world problem in risk management.
It is just wild to me. You have these incredibly detailed metrics for how many hours a room can be closed or whether someone needs a Band-Aid versus an ambulance. But when it comes to the actual money, the baseline tolerance just hasn't been set.
Nope.
It's like the document is admitting, we know an attack will cost us money, but we have absolutely no idea how much financial ruin this specific organization is actually willing to tolerate before they fold.
It proves how difficult it is to quantify financial ruin when the stakeholders haven't defined their own pain threshold.
Yeah.
If the board of directors hasn't defined what an acceptable financial loss looks like, the security assessor just has a giant hole in their matrix.
They don't know if a $50,000 loss is a level two nuisance or a level five bankruptcy.
Exactly. Which completely validates why the finance director absolutely must be on that initial Teams call.
Okay, so we have all these detailed matrices, the shared data, the HIC principles, the mathematical scores.
Lots of prep work.
Tons. With all of this digital groundwork, it sounds like a security professional could just open their laptop, run the 5x5 numbers from their living room, and build an airtight security plan.
Well, the source material is quite emphatic on this point. Absolutely not.
Right. The text is remarkably blunt about this. It discusses the practice of undertaking a desk-based risk assessment.
And what does it say?
It says, and I quote, "In our opinion, doing so is flawed." It goes on to call it a half job and literally describes it as a lazy approach to risk management.
They are not mincing words.
Not at all. Huh. Why is doing the math from a desk so dangerous?
Because a spreadsheet cannot capture physical reality. Relying solely on a desk-based assessment inherently increases your risk by introducing three specific dangers.
Which are
unseen vulnerabilities, ignored risks, and acting on insufficiently accurate information.
I mean, think about how often we do this in our own jobs.
All the time.
We review a project plan on a PDF, the numbers look good, and we approve it. We completely miss the fact that the actual operational culture on the factory floor or in the office is completely different from what is written on paper.
Right. A floor plan on a PDF might show a solid wall securing a gallery.
Looks perfectly safe.
But when you arrive in person, you might find that the wall is structurally compromised by water damage, or there is an unmapped ventilation shaft large enough for a person to crawl through.
Oh, wow.
Or, tying back to our earlier point, you discover the security culture is terrible and the guards are literally leaving the fire exit propped open to take smoke breaks.
And you cannot see a propped open door on a 5x5 matrix.
Exactly. You just can't.
But the text does offer a small caveat for desk work, doesn't it?
It does. It clarifies that a desk-based assessment is acceptable strictly as an initial indicator of possible risks.
Just to get a baseline.
Right. It's a way to process the information gathered from the stakeholders so the assessor can contextualize what they expect to find. But it is only preparation.
Okay.
The text notes that conducting the actual site visit is so critical it gets its own dedicated section referred to as Part 2A. You have to merge the theoretical framework with the physical reality.
So you can't just phone it in. You have to get out of the chair and actually walk the floor.
Absolutely.
So what does this all mean? If you take all the pieces of this deep dive together, the core message is that effective risk management is never about generic, out-of-the-box solutions.
Never.
It doesn't matter if you're trying to protect a diamond-encrusted crown or you're managing a high-stakes logistics project at your own job. You cannot rely on assumptions.
You need specific context.
You absolutely must endure that cross-departmental meeting to engage the stakeholders who actually know the value of what is at stake. You have to establish a shared mathematical language to strip away the emotion. And finally, you have to get out from behind the desk to see the messy reality of the situation on the ground.
And, you know, if we connect this to the bigger picture, this raises an important question for all of us.
Oh.
We have spent this entire time talking about physical assets, diamonds, paintings, and the physical safety of crowds. We use that 5x5 matrix to map out the catastrophic impacts to a museum.
Right.
But think about your own digital footprint.
Oh, that's an interesting pivot.
every single time an app on your phone updates its privacy policy or a corporation stores your credit card data, they are running this exact same risk matrix on your life.
They know their operational risk.
Yes. They have calculated their acceptable financial loss if they get hacked and your data is stolen. The question is, have you calculated yours?
Wow.
When you click accept on those terms and conditions, are you acting like the lazy security guard doing a desk-based assessment? Just ignoring the unseen vulnerabilities of where your data actually lives?
That is a chilling thought. We just trust these companies have a flawless security culture, but they might just be leaving the digital fire exit propped open. You can't protect your own assets if you haven't bothered to calculate the impact of losing them. The next time you find yourself wandering through a museum, looking past the velvet ropes, take a second to appreciate not just the art, but that incredible, invisible web of decisions, intense debates, mathematical matrices, and physical site visits that keeps it all safe. Thank you for coming along on this deep dive into the source material with us. Keep your eyes open and keep questioning the security of the systems around you.